It's 1975, and a student at KU is struggling with a short story he's writing. He's chatting with a professor about it, the dialogue, the characters, it isn't quite right. And the professor, a theater professor, makes a suggestion. Maybe it doesn't want to be a short story. Maybe it wants to be a play. The professor was right. The student, Paul Stephen Lim, turned that story into a play, his first, and it went on to win a college playwriting award the next year. It would go on to be performed at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C., and that would be the beginning of a long career in writing, in the theater, and teaching at KU. Today, the Kennedy Center's College Theater Festival even has an award for playwriting that's named after him. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman, and today on Central Standard, our portrait session is with Paul Stephen Lim, and he's here. Welcome to you, Paul.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
It's really a privilege to have you here. What was that play called?
That play was called Con Personas, one word, and it's a word that I made up. In terms of whether it could be a pro or con persons in a play.
Like against persons?
Yes, for or against.
Interesting. And what was it about?
It was about a pair of identical twins, one of whom is an advertising man working in New York City with a very fancy apartment, and his identical twin is a Jesuit priest. And the play takes place on the evening of Thanksgiving, and the advertising man has made very elaborate preparations for a dinner, and he has invited three very special guests. And moments before the guests arrive, he puts on the tail end of Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture, and he disappears into his bedroom, and we hear a gunshot. So then the guests arrive, thinking that maybe he had just gone out for some errands. And when he doesn't show up, they explore the apartment and then, of course, discover the fact that he had committed suicide in the bedroom. And shortly after that, his identical twin, the Jesuit priest, bursts into the apartment because he had had some sixth sense that something wrong was happening, which, in fact, a lot of identical twins say the same thing because of the identical genes. And so then the rest of the play is the Jesuit priest trying to find out from these three guests what the nature of their relationships are with the advertising man, his brother. And oddly, in the course of the next 2 hours, the Jesuit priest himself relives all of these same relationships with the same tragic ending that he too, at the end of the play, goes off and kills himself.
So this was your first play. It features an ad man and a Jesuit priest. This from someone who, prior to this, had been an advertising copywriter and had attended Jesuit schools.
Yes, absolutely right. You know, I didn't think of it that way, but it was just something. It was a world that I knew. I had been in advertising in the Philippines for over 6 years, and I had been to a number of Jesuit and Christian Brothers institutions. And so it was a world that I knew and I could write about.
Well, take us back there. What was your life like in the Philippines before you came to the United States?
I was born of Chinese parents in Manila. Both of my parents were born in the south of China and emigrated to the Philippines. So my mother came as a child bride from China at the age of 14.
Wow.
She had three children. I was the third of three children. So I grew up as a member of the Chinese community in the Philippines. And there was a great deal of racism against the Chinese at that time. Primarily because I think the Chinese economically was the ruling class.
And how conscious were you of that racism you were dealing with as a child?
It was something that I grew up with, and it wasn't something that, you know, that I thought about much. But of course, as soon as I left the Philippines and came to the States in July of 1968, you begin to see things a little bit differently.
Why did you come to the United States? I mean, take us back. Because you went to college in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do with that education there?
Actually, I had dropped out of school in 1962 because I was just incredibly bored in school and was very, very, you know, arrogant, thinking that perhaps, you know, I knew more than my teachers. And
I've never heard of a college student who felt that way.
Yeah, so I dropped out of school and drifted into newspaper work, writing stories for magazines and newspapers. And then I drifted into advertising. I worked for J. Walter Thompson and had some success as a copywriter for a variety of international accounts. And you know the show Mad Men?
Uh-huh.
That's the period.
That was your life.
That was the period I was working in for J. Walter Thompson.
Was there as much drinking in the office as
And, of course, the sexism. Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the cigarettes.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Do you remember anything you wrote during that period?
I think I had two claims to fame. We had the 7-Up account at the time, and they were competing, as indeed, you know, everywhere else, with Coke and Pepsi. So they wanted to come up with an advertising campaign go against Coke and Pepsi. And we were all, the copywriters were all given these huge marketing books from 7-Up, and they kept referring to Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola as the non-colas. And the copywriters were asked to come up with some kind of an advertising campaign. And for me, it was just natural to go from non-cola to un-cola. So the Uncola campaign was, in fact, mine, although I was never credited with it, because the call for advertising ideas went out to 50 different countries in which J. Walter Thompson was operating.
And so it came from the Philippines, so it wasn't...
Right. Yeah, so the Uncola was my idea.
No kidding. That seems like a really big claim to fame.
Well, I'm proud of it.
But it wasn't the last thing you did. Why'd you want to get out of advertising anyway?
Well, I had been working steadily, night and day, on a campaign for a bank in the Philippines that was going to issue a series of bonds. And we were working very, very hard on this campaign, as I said, night and day. And the client was very difficult to please. And so finally, they did approve a campaign that I had worked on. And I was coming home on public transportation one night. And I saw the man sitting across from me with a copy of the Manila Times, one of the newspapers in which we had a double spread, announcing the launching of these bonds being issued by the bank. And the man never even looked at the two pages in which the ads were in and on which I had worked so hard. Mm. He just turned those pages right over, and my heart sank at that point. And I thought, I spent 6 months of my life working on this, and that's it. That's gone. I'm gone. So I went home and I told my mother I was leaving for the States. And I was, in fact, on a plane a week later.
Wow. So I guess I understand the desire to come to America, see what happens here. But why Kansas? Why did you end up at KU?
I had an older brother who had a scholarship to KU. And so I knew about Kansas, and he gave me the name of the Dean of Foreign Students. And then I also remembered that back in the Philippines, I had met a Professor Grant Goodman, a member of the History Department at KU, and I had helped Grant Goodman with some of his research. And through the years, we had kept in touch. So when I ended up in New York and my time was running out on my tourist visa, And I was told by immigration that I had to leave the country or else the next best thing was to shift to a student visa. I remembered Grant Goodman, and I gave him a call. And indeed, he was very, very kind. And he said, sure, I can make arrangements for you to enroll at KU. And I said, but I don't have my transcripts with me. And he said, not a problem. That can come later. And in fact, he did arrange for me to be enrolled in January of 1969 at KU. So I flew out to KU, had a look, and I stayed. And I've been here ever since.
Starting with a six-month visa.
Correct.
So that story we started the show with about your writing of Con Personas, how far into your college career was that moment?
I came to the States in 69. I mean, I started at KU in 69, and I was more determined to write short fiction, actually. And so I was writing a lot of short stories, and a lot of them were getting published in the Philippines and elsewhere, and had began to win some awards again in the Philippines. And so that was very encouraging for me. So I never thought about writing plays because going to the theater was not part of our culture in the Philippines.
I guess I'm curious then how you thought of yourself. I'm curious about the identity of a writer. You were writing short stories, but you were making a living as an ad copywriter. Mm-hmm. You came to America. You tried your hand at fiction. You moved on to playwriting with this particular moment. Did you think of yourself as a writer? Was that your identity, or were you just a person who wrote?
No, I always thought of myself as a writer. All of my friends in the Philippines were similarly oriented, and we lived fiction and nonfiction. We lived screenplays, the movies. But theater was not part of our experience there.
What do you mean you lived them rather than read them?
We would go to the movies and we would spend endless hours afterwards discussing the ifs, whens, and buts and howevers of screenplays. As a matter of fact, after we saw the movie Tea and Sympathy, we had a great deal of discussion about the last line of Tea and Sympathy, in which the older woman goes into the bedroom of the younger man who was unsure of his sexuality, and the older woman initiates a physical relationship with the young man. And the last line in the play, she says to him, years from now, ... when you talk about this, ... you will, ... be kind. So my friends and I discussed this endlessly as to what those ellipses meant, because on the one hand, it could mean years from now when you talk about this, and you will talk about this, you will at that time be kind. Or it could mean years from now when you talk about this, you will please be kind. We couldn't.
This is the kind of discussion you and your friends
would have. Oh, absolutely. And so I wrote off to the playwright, and lo and behold, he did answer. And he said, that's an interesting question. And of course, I intended both of them.
Mm-hmm.
And years later, I actually met him in my work as a playwright. And we laughed about this.
The voice you're hearing is Paul Stephen Lim. He's a playwright and a retired professor from KU, talking about his life and career in our Friday portrait session. Can you connect the growing up experience in the Philippines with your family, with your very young mother who had three young children, to the writing that you would eventually go on to do? How did it emerge in your artistic work?
I didn't feel that I was ready to write about my Asian American or Asian background until mid-career. One of the prizes I got from the Kennedy Center play was representation by the William Morris Agency in New York. And the agent who was assigned me was the top agent in New York at the time. And he told me that that he could find work very easily for me, but I had to move to New York. He said, don't stay in Kansas because there's no way I can get work for you. And he said, however, if you stay in Kansas, then maybe you can, you know, just write about Asian and Asian American stuff. And maybe I can, you know, get these things published for you or put on stage. But I didn't feel I was ready to do that back in 1976. I was determined to write about a lot of other things I was interested in before I wanted to write about my own background, particularly about my mother.
I want to dig into that a little further, but you mentioned you got this this award. That play won a prize. It actually would go on to be performed at the Kennedy Center, right?
Yes.
How did that come about? Did you get to go see the performance? What was that experience like?
Oh, yes. The entire KU production was flown to Washington, D.C., and we performed at the beautiful Eisenhower Theater at the Kennedy Center. And when the curtain parted, the audience clapped the set. And one of the ushers told me that in her years of ushering at the Eisenhower Theater at the Kennedy Center, that she had never, ever seen an audience or heard an audience applaud a set. So that was the KU set, which was designed by Greg Hill.
Yeah, and it went uphill from there, I trust.
My mother came from the Philippines to see the play.
Wow.
And she sat on the third row, and she was smiling through all of it. Afterwards, the press asked her why she was smiling, because the play was a tragedy. And she said, it's by my son.
I'm curious what impact that play's production had then on your professional life. You chose not to move to New York, as you said. What happened then as a result? Were there other good things?
Well, then I was hooked, and I had been offered a half-time teaching position in the English department at KU, and I didn't think that I would adjust to small-town life after living in metropolitan Manila. But I did, in fact, like living in a small town and my friends there. And so I think in many ways I made the right decision, because I've had a wonderful career in academia.
How much of your professional identity now comes from the years you spent teaching others to write versus your own writing?
One of the wonderful things about teaching younger writers is that the language continues to be very much alive for me. I'm absolutely fascinated by how the language changes, even from year to year or semester to semester, the kinds of how our students speak and communicate with each other. And as a writer, as a playwright, I think that was absolutely important for me to know how to write parts for young people, if ever I should write plays for young people.
Well, let's pause for a moment in this conversation with Paul Stephen Lim. After a break, we'll talk more about his writing life and some of his better-known plays, maybe some of his lesser ones, as well as the work that he did sort of running his own alternative theater out of the KU Theater Department. We'll look at the impact on students and on the community and on him. Central Standard returns in a moment. Don't go away. It's KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, and Paul Stephen Lim is here for our portrait session on this Friday morning. We're talking about his life as a playwright. You published many plays, Paul, that were produced locally and regionally and off-Broadway. Is there one play that you think of as your favorite?
Oh, gosh. It's like asking who's your favorite child, yes.
But some parents have one, even if they don't like to talk about it.
Well, one play of mine that that went over in a very peculiar way was a play called Homerica, which was a play in three acts. And that play had a very peculiar reception in Lawrence. And that's the one that I think about frequently and wonder whether it was the play itself or whether it was the production or whether I was too far ahead of our time in addressing things that made people really, really uncomfortable.
What were the things you addressed that caused that reaction?
Well, it was a play called Homerica. Again, it's a made-up word, and I called it a trilogy on the sexual revolution.
And, so the home in Homerica is homosexuality?
Well, no, not necessarily.
Okay.
It's Homer.
Homer.
Homer, the Greek Homer. It's the journey that the epic journey that Homer writes about. And so the whole play takes place in New York City in a basement in the Village. And the first act is an antiquarian bookstore that is going out of business because people no longer read books. And the old antiquarian British bookseller has decided to go back home to the UK. And he's waiting for the taxi to come and take him to the airport. And he has with him his six favorite books that he is holding on to from the bookstore. And in the course of that first act, characters from these six books, who are all highly sexually charged characters, come to life and interact with him in the bookstore. And it ends with him, the cab coming for him, and him going to the airport with and these six characters remain behind. They don't go with him. The second act, the bookstore has been turned into a singles bar. So the first act takes place in the past, the second act in the present, and it's a very tawdry and lurid singles bar. And the six highly sexually charged characters from the first act reappear as contemporary citizens in New York City in the mid and late 1970s at the height of the sexual revolution. And we see the consequences of quote-unquote sexual liberation. And again, the bar is going out of business, and the way it's put in the play is that singles bar are no longer necessary because people are doing it everywhere, out in the open, in the streets, in the parks, and what point is there of having a meeting place in a bar? So the bar is going out of business. And in the third act, which is set in the future, we're in a futuristic travel agency where women in America are no longer interested in bearing their own children. And so the business of this travel agency is to fly Irish nuns in and out of Ireland to New York City to be surrogate wombs for American women who no longer wish to have children.
So what kind of reaction did this play get?
People walked out.
In which act? I'm curious.
In the second act, people started to walk out because a wedding is taking place in the bar where the bartender is getting married to the bouncer. And a preacher had been called in. And, of course, everybody is very, very drunk. And I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, but there's a gangbang that takes place in the course of the play. And the preacher says something that people were offended by.
Mm. Okay. So I asked what your favorite play was, and this is the one that came to mind. You like that it got that kind of reaction or started those kinds of conversations?
Because it may have been a damaged child in that sense, that I don't know if I went too far. Because if the point of a play is to communicate with an audience, you don't want to shut the door and have the audience leave and not be interested in hearing whatever argument you might have. So I don't know if it was the production itself that went overboard or whether it was the script itself. I subsequently directed the play myself in Ireland. And it went over well in Ireland, despite the fact that it had all of these pregnant Irish nuns.
Well, if you have ever read or maybe even performed the work of Paul Stephen Lim, Irish nuns or otherwise, maybe you studied with him at KU. We'd like to hear your perceptions and experiences. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. It's 235-2888. Paul, you mentioned in the first act, if you will, of our program that you were a little reluctant to write about your experiences as an Asian or from an Asian American perspective. Mm-hmm. You were something of a rarity, I have to think, when you started out as an Asian American playwright. Mm-hmm. Should it surprise us that you didn't want to write from that perspective early on? Or do you feel like that was a very natural choice you were making?
Well, I felt that I wanted to write about my mother and about my family, and I was a little bit hesitant because they were all still alive, and I was afraid I might hurt them if I wrote plays about them. And in fact, I wrote a one-act play called Points of Departure, which came from a real incident that happened in my family with my mother, and my mother happened to be in San Francisco at the time when the play premiered there, and she went to see it, and there was a cast party afterwards, and the woman who played my mother in the play went up to my mom at the party and said, "Well, Mrs. Lim, how did you like seeing yourself portrayed on the stage?" And my mother looked very surprised, and she said, "No, that's not me on the stage." So she didn't recognize herself, which was kind of interesting because she remained true to form because she was, again, in denial with the second play that I wrote about her. She claimed that I got it all wrong, but of course I didn't because I had, prior to writing the play, asked her to put on cassette tape her recollections of her childhood and her early marriage. And so I have the proof on tape in her own voice. And I used a lot of her own language in the play. But later she claimed that the things I wrote about weren't true.
Sometimes it's hard to see things in front of you, even if they were in your mind as true before that.
Yes, absolutely.
Was that the first play then where you feel like you did draw on your own experiences and in some sense on your Asian American identity?
Points of Departure, the one act, which was first done in L.A. and then they had another production in San Francisco. That was the first time I tackled Asian American material.
And did that become then a bigger part of your writing?
It took another couple of years before I decided to write the play about my mother, the full-length play about my mother, which was called Mother Tongue. Again, it's a play about language, but it involved my mother, who went from speaking Fukienese, a southern dialect in China, to English and Tagalog, and Mandarin in the Philippines, and then English exclusively in the States. And that's been sort of my own journey as well in terms of language.
Yeah, was English the language you were speaking at home before you came to the U.S.?
No, the language I spoke at home was Fukienese, which was, as I said, a dialect in southern China. At home, that's what we spoke. And then in the streets, we would speak Tagalog, the language of the Philippines. And in school, we would speak English and Spanish.
And how much, so you went on to write this play about language. Were linguistic issues part of this journey for you? Was it ever difficult to find the ways to communicate early on?
No, not at all.
Not at all.
Not at all.
Yeah. Do you recall a moment that you had as a teacher where you had the same experience you had as a student, where you said to a student, "Try that as a play," or where something else you said led someone else to find success as a writer?
Yes, actually, there was this young woman in my class who was writing a 10-minute play about creation myths. And she was drawing from the Japanese creation myth. And in her 10-minute play, she was writing about a man and a woman having a quarrel and a marriage breaking apart in the course of the 10 minutes. And it was her attempt to retell the Japanese creation myth through the breakup of this marriage of this young couple. And I, in a session with her, I said to her, how do you envision this play? How would it look on stage? And she said she really had no idea how it might be staged because it seemed very static, you know, the man and the woman sitting there arguing. Mm-hmm. So then I said, might you consider the woman at her vanity table maybe putting on her makeup and getting ready to go out for the evening? And I said, in the course of her putting on makeup, what if she were to put on white mascara makeup and to put her hair up in a bun and then to end with putting a pair of chopsticks into her hair as though she's dressing up as a geisha because of the retelling of the Japanese creation myth. And that sparked something in her, and she went away and completely rewrote her 10-minute play, and as a matter of fact, we staged it, and we entered it in the same competition, the American College Theater Festival of the Kennedy Center, and it won. And her play was performed at the Kennedy Center, and it was judged the best 10-minute play of the year that year. And so in many ways, I felt like it had come full circle.
Yeah.
That I had helped a student get to the Kennedy Center.
What's her name?
Oh gosh, I was afraid you were going to ask it.
That's all right. We can look it up, but it must feel very gratifying to know that you were able to sort of continue that cycle.
I've lost touch with her.
Besides the teaching that you've done, you also ran a theater at KU, out of the KU English department, right?
Right.
Tell us about the English Alternative Theater.
When I was hired to teach playwriting full-time at KU in 1989, I think it became evident very, very quickly that the only way a playwright, a young emerging playwright, can learn is if his or her play the words were being spoken by actors in front of an audience. And that we were able to get some kind of feedback from the audience about what's working and what's not working. And of course, there's very little interest in original scripts, not just in Lawrence, Kansas, but anywhere in America. Original scripts are a hard sell. Mm-hmm. People want to go to something they're familiar with and to go to something that they have no idea what it is. It takes a very adventurous theater goer to go. So, and of course, none of the theaters in Lawrence, including the university theater in the theater department, were interested in doing original scripts. So, again, with the help of my friend Grant Goodman, who was a great aficionado of theater, he gave us a grant, and that was when I started English Alternative Theater. Devoted primarily to staging original scripts by my students.
And how was that received? Was it a popular destination in Lawrence, or was it more important because it was happening rather than how it was received?
Well, I think my years in advertising helped.
Very good.
Yeah, and you know, I was designing the posters, writing the press releases. I was frequently directing the place myself, helping gather the props, the costumes, helping with the sets. So it was really, in many ways, a one-man production unit. Getting audiences in was very difficult, but I was able to convince some of the drama classes in the English department to require or to give extra credit to their students to come see the plays. Mm-hmm. And so we would get fairly good crowds.
I wonder if being on that production side of the plays, even directing plays, changed how you wrote plays.
Well, I passed on what I myself had learned to my students, which was that your play is more likely to get produced if you have less than 6 characters and you have only one set. If you require multiple sets or if you require more than 6 actors, the chances of your play getting produced are slim.
Well, let's take one more break. KCUR's Central Standard will be back in just a moment. We'll keep talking with Paul Stephen Lim and get his take on the state of Asian Americans and other people of color in the theater and in Hollywood. If you know his work, want to add your take, call us at 816-235-2888. I'm Brian Ellison. Don't go away. We're getting to know Paul Stephen Lim today on KCUR's Central Standard, the playwright and retired KU professor. I'm Brian Ellison. People have been talking for years about Hollywood's lack of diversity. Much of that came to a head last year and this year at the Oscars. We talked a little already today, Paul, about your initial reticence to write about your own experience as a person from an Asian background or as an Asian American, but how that eventually worked its way more into your writing. I'm curious, as you look at today's entertainment industry, today's creative world, and as a prominent Asian American in that world yourself, what's your take on Oscars so white and on that whole controversy?
Well, I think Asian Americans are still taking baby steps because as far as minorities go, I think your voice gets to be heard when the minority group gets much larger, and therefore you witness groups like African Americans first, and then Hispanic Americans, and then you get the GL, the gay faction, and so the larger the minority group, the more your voice will be heard. And unfortunately, Asian Americans and Native Americans are not up there in terms of numbers for the media to be cognizant and to be aware and to focus on Asian and Asian American issues.
Why do you think that is?
Because the audience isn't there. And you would be targeting a very specific audience if you were to do Asian American material. I think it worked more effectively in print for Asian Americans than it did in the movies or in theater. In print, we got a great many novels and essays that appeared on the scene starting in the mid-70s with Maxine Hong Kingston's A Woman Warrior and Chinamen. And then thanks to Maxine Hong Kingston, there was a great deal of interest in print, in fiction, on Asian American material so that you would get writers like Amy Tan. But on the other hand, when you got playwrights like Frank Chin writing plays, Frank Chin's plays were hardly ever produced outside of L.A. and San Francisco. Whereas if you wrote a novel like, you know, Amy Tan was writing or like books like Maxine Hong Kingston was writing, then these can be distributed nationally and would find a bigger audience.
Is that the same in theater as it is in Hollywood to this day? Do you feel like Asian American theater is still lacking?
Baby steps, absolutely. Because I mean, I live in Lawrence, Kansas. If I were to write another play about Asian Americans, where would I find the actors? There would be no actors for me to call on. As a matter of fact, even in Washington, D.C., they're having trouble. The other day, I got a couple of email messages from Greg Henry at the Kennedy Center asking for recommendations for Chinese-American actors because they had a wonderful play that they wanted to do. And even in D.C., they couldn't find a Chinese-American actor. And, you know, given their proximity to New York City, I was really surprised that they weren't able to find in 2016 a Chinese-American actor who could be in this wonderful play that they wanted to do.
Can you speculate about why that would be the case?
Again, perhaps the arts is not something that Asians and Asian-Americans gravitate towards. I think Asian and Asian-Americans deal more with the sciences and maybe with commerce, business, Wall Street. And so there are not really that many Asian or Asian Americans in the arts.
I'm thinking about a lot of the controversy or conversation, at least, around the television series, Fresh Off the
Fresh
Boat.
Fresh Off the Boat, yeah.
Came out first Asian American ensemble sitcom in primetime since Margaret Cho back in 1994.
Right.
Had some questions raised about the kind of representation of Asian Americans that this program, just like Margaret Cho's program, had.
Right.
What's your take on that? Is that a positive step because it's moving forward Asian Americans in the entertainment industry?
Well, if you're telling the truth, and you know, part of what it is like to grow up as Asian and Asian American, and if you're telling the truth, inevitably, I think the picture that you paint will in some ways be stereotypical. And if you don't like the word stereotypical, then maybe you can say archetypal. But there might be then some objection to the way you're being depicted. And so I was told, for instance, in parts of my play, Mother Tongue, about my mother, one person came up to me and said, "Why are you washing dirty laundry in public?" Mm. And so there's some reticence to actually share life as it is led among first and second generation Chinese Americans and Japanese Americans. Things might change with the third and fourth generation, people like Margaret Cho and the family being depicted in Fresh Off the Boat. I mean, these are not first or second generation Asians. These are third and fourth generation.
One of the actresses, actors, Constance Wu, has been particularly outspoken about the need to see more Asian American actors in Hollywood, in television, and I assume on the stage as well.
Absolutely. But like I say, it's not part really of the growing up experience amongst Asian Americans. Thus, the stereotype that the computer nerd, the math whiz, that these are this is where the Asians are. You don't think of Asians as painters or architects or composers, although there are. I mean, you know, Tan Dun is a wonderful Chinese American composer. There are wonderful Asian American architects, but they're not the norm. I mean, they are in the minority.
One step being taken through that same Kennedy Center American College Theater Festival these days is an award specifically for Asian American writers, and it's named after you. Tell us about the Paul Stephen Lim Playwriting Award.
Again, this is thanks to Greg Henry. Once he took over the American College Theater Festival at the Kennedy Center, he broadened the scope of the KCACTF, and there are now a multitude of awards. There are awards for Hispanic American playwrights, for playwrights with disabilities, for African American playwrights. So he approached me shortly after I retired, and he said, "Given all of the work that you've done with KCACTF, why don't we name an Asian American Playwriting Award in your name?" And I was very, very flattered. And they've been getting, you know, anywhere from 20 to 30 submissions a year through various colleges and universities. And so they've been awarding two prizes a year for the last 5 years. And I get interesting email messages from some of these winning playwrights, and I get to read their plays. And it's wonderful to see the kinds of plays that the younger Asian Americans are writing.
What kinds of plays are they? How are they different from what you wrote?
Again, these are the younger playwrights, because in the old days, it would be plays about the problems of integration, problems with discrimination. These were very typical of the plays that were being written 10, 15, even 5 years ago. But now it's more mainstream. And except for the names and some of the cuisine that's being served, it's more a lot more mainstream.
Mainstream meaning it's not focused on the differences of Asian American experience.
But the similarities of what makes us alike rather than different.
And do you take that as a positive development or does that concern you?
I see it as an interesting next step. Because after you are fully integrated, then I think the next generation will want to rediscover its roots. I find it interesting, for example, that they are now redoing Roots, that there's a new version of Roots coming out,
right.
And they're saying that it's a lot better than the first Roots. And I don't know if this is just publicity speaking or whether, in fact, the first Roots was not able to tackle it honestly enough. And that now maybe we're ready for a more honest route.
The story changes as the lens of the viewer changes.
Absolutely.
Are you still writing? What does retirement from teaching look like for you as a writer?
Well, I was so burnt out 5 years ago after running English Alternative Theater for over 20 years that I swore I would never go near the theater again.
Really?
But I do have material for three different plays that are kind of like on the back burner. A place that I had put aside through the years because of the work involved in putting on English Alternative Theater and the plays of my students. So I do have these three plays on the back burner, and I hope to get back to them soon. But right now, I mean, it's been 5 years, but I'm really enjoying retirement, and so does my dog.
Do you still get to the theater?
I tried to go to Kansas City Theater. I subscribed to the Unicorn Theater, and I tried to go to New York at least once a year, preferably around May prior to the Tony Awards, to see the best of what's being offered.
I wonder if it would be surreal for someone who has made their career in theater to go and watch other people's work at this stage of your life.
No, not really. I love going to this. I love going to good theater, but I hate going to bad theater. And when I was still in academia and involved with my own theater, I had to go see everything that was there, and some of it was pretty dismal.
Yeah. I wonder what piece of advice you, given this career and frankly this distaste for bad theater, what piece of advice you would give to a young playwright, maybe someone who's just moved to the United States. What would you say to someone who is in what were your shoes?
Well, I think there is no substitute for going to live theater, good or bad. And if you are like me and my friends back in high school, you can learn from most everything, the good as well as the bad, because if you are not enjoying something, you can discuss it and say, why didn't I enjoy it? What was wrong with it? Was it the material or was it me? And so you can learn a great deal even from that which is dismal or horrible.
Not to do.
And if something is working well, you can discuss it, you know, as well and say, what did I like about it and what made it work? Why did I laugh? Why did I cry? So there's no substitute for going to live theater. And in the absence of live theater, then, of course, the next best thing would be to read plays, to see how plays are structured, what sort of material works and not on in print. And, of course, with the availability of video, there are thousands of plays that you can watch in video and learn from.
Well, Paul Stephen Lim, it has been a great privilege and joy to talk with you today. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Brian.
It's Paul Stephen Lim. His work as a playwright and as a professor at KU is something you can find out more about online at kcur.org/centralstandard. This is our portrait session, and that means it comes with gorgeous photographs by Paul Andrews. You can read Paul Stephen Lim's story, see the photos, and listen to today's show later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. You can find all our past shows there, too. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. and I'm at PTS Brian. Join us on Monday at 10 a.m. KCUR is giving you a chance to enjoy some special programming, a show called The Pulse, when they'll be looking at death and some peculiar medical options for the living. You can join us again on Tuesday. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, with Fridays by Jen Chen. Our interns are Glenn Frizzell and Anna Sterla. Our announcer is Linda Scher, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. Gina Kaufman's on leave. I'm Brian Ellison. Happy First Friday, everyone, and have a great weekend.